Robert Moses once said, "Those who can build, those who can't criticize." And Moses, the subject of Robert Caro's classic, The Power Broker, did inspire a fair amount of criticism, despite being responsible for shaping New York during much of the 20th century with large-scale projects like the Triborough Bridge, the West Side Highway, and 658 parks throughout the city. Perhaps his most famous opponent was Jane Jacobs, the West Village-based writer and activist who fought with Moses in the 1960s over his plan for an elevated Lower Manhattan expressway and a highway that would run through Washington Square Park. The struggle over these projects is recounted in Anthony Flint's new book called Wrestling with Moses, How Jane Jacobs Took on New York's Master Builder and Transformed the American City. It's published by Random House. I'm very pleased that it has brought Mr. Flint to our show today. Hello.
It's great to be here.
Just last month, the city named the block between Hudson Street, between Perry and West 11th, Jane Jacobs Way. Is this a sign that she continues to be seen as the victor in the struggles with Robert Moses?
Well, I think it is one sign, and certainly she could be viewed as the great defender of New York, the woman who had the gumption and the courage to stand up and to fight City Hall, essentially, at a time when not a lot of women were in the business of urban planning or design or architecture schools and so forth, at a time when we were just beginning to sort of take on the establishment.
Well, Robert Moses did a lot of good things in the city. Is there a street named after him?
Well, there's a
There's Riverside Park. They didn't call it Robert Moses Park.
No, they didn't. But there's Robert Moses Park and the beach out in Long Island, and of course his legacy it really endures around New York City. Of course, if you walk down a bridge or a road or play in a park, it's quite likely that Moses had something to do with it.
And it's interesting that this is happening now with Jane Jacobs. She moved to Toronto in 1968, and she died 3 years ago.
Yes. She had sort of had it with New York by 1968. She was also worried about her two sons and wanted to protect them from the draft. She was a big Vietnam War protester. And all of this informed her decision to pick up and leave 555 Hudson Street and head to Toronto, where she actually became a Canadian citizen.
And then started writing books that had nothing to do with urban affairs. I interviewed her on a book that had to do with philosophy.
Yes, she for someone who didn't have a college degree, actually, she had an incredibly powerful intellect. And she was quite scholarly in a way. She started getting interested in chaos theory and fractals and economic theory, and she was quite good at it actually. And her subsequent books did have a lot to do with cities, but as I say in the book, she was most famous for the death and life of great American cities, almost like a rock star who always gets asked to play the same old favorite tune.
Are there people who were involved on both sides of this debate still alive to interview?
There were some. One example is Carol Greitzer, who was a city councilor at the time and was a colleague of Jane Jacobs. She's one of the people, along with Ed Koch, who Jacobs sort of came alongside and said, you could really get some political mileage out of joining these neighbors who are so concerned about these various projects like urban renewal or running a roadway through Washington Square Park.
So, well, she wasn't alone, obviously. She's perhaps the most prominent activist, but many people were concerned about these things.
Yes, absolutely. She was just particularly good at the strategy and setting up photo ops and that sort of thing, and working with the media and bringing along sympathy to the cause. She was just a little bit better at that than some of the other folks.
And she grew up in Scranton, and that had an actual impact on her thinking about how a city should work?
It did. It was
Scranton is nothing like New York.
Nothing like New York, but the downtown had the same elements of urbanism that she came to embrace. It was a walkable place. It had a a sense of vitality and a center. There was a mix of uses. It had a very human feeling, not unlike Greenwich Village. And it was also, though, in the middle of Pennsylvania coal country, and she began to understand the economic forces at work and how cities could really be sort of hubs of innovation, and as the cities go, really the economy goes.
On the other hand, Robert Moses grew up in rather privileged circumstances in Connecticut, a child of wealth and prestige. Do you think that gave him a certain sense of entitlement, or is that something that developed over the years as he became more and more powerful?
There's no question that he came from a privileged background, a townhouse on the Upper East Side with servants. He was ferried around in limousines so much he never learned to drive, never got a driver's license. He went to Yale and Oxford and really had this sort of blue-chip pedigree. Now, he was a Jew at Yale, so that carried some challenges. And so I wouldn't say that he felt like he was skating along in any kind of privileged way. He really had to fight for what he got.
And he did have strong opinions about slum clearance. Let's listen to a little clip, something that he said in 1958.
I doubt whether anything short of visible, palpable, undeniable accomplishment on a big scale will answer the critics, or whether the average citizen will ever grasp how complex, aggravating, and thankless our task has been. Few comprehend the differences between the various types of low, middle, and high-income slum clearance housing, their interrelation, the place of each, the logical balance of business and industry, the difficulty of attracting sponsors, moving people, gradual demolition and piecemeal building, and how easy it is for sidewalk superintendents to bend down and sling mud and rocks lifted from the excavations.
Is that typical of his thinking?
It was, right down to the rhetorical flourishes. He was a master at this kind of engagement. And one of the things that makes the story of his clash with Jane Jacobs so wonderful. But yes, he was here to save New York. And he saw that.
And to help the poor people, as he saw it.
With the housing, certainly. He was in favor of introducing as much housing as possible. And this was a way of increasing supply. And while some of the units ended up being more middle class or even luxury units, there was also the low income housing in those housing towers. But he was out to make New York economically competitive, and his methods ended up being quite rough in the sense that he wasn't terribly interested in what other people, and particularly residents, had to say.
Anthony Flint is my guest. He's Director of Public Affairs at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy, which is a think tank on land and development issues. And he's been a reporter for the Boston Globe and written a number of books. The most recent, the one that we're talking about, is Wrestling with Moses, How Jane Jacobs Took on New York's Master Builder and Transformed the American City. It's published by Random House. Do you see any similarities between her personality and his?
Well, they both wrote poetry. They were both hard-charging, self-starters, didn't suffer fools. There were some similarities. And on the issue of housing, for example, she too believed that increasing supply, you know, one of the problems that is encountered today, of course, is gentrification, what she called over-success. When these urban neighborhoods like Greenwich Village or Soho become so popular and so desirable. And Jacobs believed that there should just be more and more of these great urban neighborhoods, and that way you would increase the supply of them, and it would have an impact on prices. Moses was thinking along those same lines when he thought that for economic competitiveness reasons, there should be more, much more housing available in Manhattan.
She moved to New York in 1934 to Brooklyn Heights. I would have thought she would have liked that neighborhood, but she decided Village better suited her?
Well, she came, of course, to the city in the midst of the Great Depression, and she was looking for a newspaper job. She went on interviews trying to get a job, and more often than not, though, she had some time on her hands, so she hopped in the subway and got off at Christopher Street one day and discovered Greenwich Village, and went back to her sister, Betty, who she was living with, and said, "I found the place we've just got to live." She said, "Where is it?" Jane said, "I don't know, but you get off at a place called Christopher Street."
Mm-hmm. She wound up getting journalism gigs for Vogue, for example. She wrote about the flower market in Lower Manhattan, the Diamond District, so she was always interested in urban things, and then Architectural Forum. And in the mid-50s, she was given an assignment to write about urban renewal plans in Philadelphia, and she met the planner Edmund Bacon, and he really had a major impact on her thinking.
He did. He was sort of the Robert Moses of Philadelphia, and was engaged, like many cities at the time, in the policy of urban renewal, which involved bulldozing areas that have been designated as substandard or slums. But when she went to Philadelphia, he showed her the new places, and then right next door there were some existing neighborhoods, and the older neighborhoods looked a lot better. There were people, there was activity, and so this really set her on the path of thinking, well, wait a second, was this urban renewal and modernist policy really doing any good, and in fact, was it doing harm?
But was that short-term as opposed to long-term? I'd assume that people did appreciate the fact that the area had been cleaned up.
Well, it wasn't good enough for her, really, because she's responded by saying, well, where are the people?
Well, let's play a clip for Jane Jacobs talking about this.
Time passed, and some of these things were actually built that I had written about. And this was a great shock to me, because they didn't look at all the way, the way they should have looked. They didn't work at all the way they should have worked. People didn't use them the way, presumably, people were supposed to use them. And the city around them didn't react the way, theoretically, the city around them should have reacted.
So she's saying, actually, that the planners had the best interest of people at heart, but they didn't really do it very well.
Yes, it was a real challenge to the planning profession and to architecture schools and to city development offices everywhere. She was essentially saying the emperor had no clothes, that there were these guys at their drafting tables, and they were really separated from reality. In fact, they were creating places like another place that she went and observed was in East Harlem. That were really kind of windswept and barren, and they were actually making life worse for the residents.
She said, I can remember the people in East Harlem hating a patch of green grass. I couldn't understand why until one of them told me that the tobacco store had been torn down. And she's talking also about places like Lenox Terrace, Delano Village, or Delano Village, I guess it is, Lincoln Towers, Park West Village, places that seemed like a good idea at the time.
Well, there was a real foundation of this with the Swiss-born architect Le Corbusier, who suggested this model of essentially towers in the park. And it was a way to get a lot of housing and to clean up what seemed to be battered, outdated areas. And yes, it did seem like a good idea at the time until Jane Jacobs wrote Death and Life and stood up and said it might not be.
Le Corbusier was the probably the most dominant architect of the late 50s, early 60s, and that Jane Jacobs gets some credit for changing the way people thought about him?
By taking on Moses and by pointing out some of the problems and excesses of modernism, I think she reminded us all about the value of some older neighborhoods and a streetscape that was not sleek and streamlined, but was a bit more sort of cozy and cluttered.
Well, One of our listeners, Ed from the East Village, left a comment on our show page. Jane Jacobs preserved the West Village for wealthy hipsters and preserved Soho for wealthy New Jersey shoppers. The slum clearance projects of Robert Moses still house working people.
It's an excellent point. And gentrification really is the curse of reviving cities everywhere. You can see it so clearly in the West Village, and now, of course, the Meatpacking District, and of course in Soho. It is incredible, though, to think that an urban success story like Soho could have been the site of the Lower Manhattan Expressway, a 10-lane elevated highway running down Broome Street. Thanks in large part to Jane Jacobs, that is not there. And so I appreciate the way that she allowed this neighborhood to flourish.
And I've been to Washington Square Park recently. I'm still wondering what it would be like if a highway was running right through it. The tendency has been to close down the highways running through our parks. Prospect Park, often the roadway is closed down and people use it instead, which I would assume is the reason we have these parks in the first place. But the debate will continue, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break here. My guest is Anthony Flint. His book, Wrestling with Moses, How Jane Jacobs Took on New York's Master Builder and Transformed the American City. It is published by Random House.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We're back with Anthony Flint, Director of Public Affairs at the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy, a think tank on land and development issues that's located in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He was a reporter at the Boston Globe for 16 years. He's the author of This Land, The Battle Over Sprawl and the Future of America. And his latest book is Wrestling with Moses, How Jane Jacobs Took on New York's Master Builder and Transformed the American City, published by Random House. So do we see her the legacy of this battle in Boston, where you live?
Yes, and I think cities everywhere. Jane Jacobs was really prescient in recognizing how important cities are. And I think today, in the context of energy and climate change, cities are really the places where a lot of the action is going to take place. They're green places to live in the end because they have density and transit, and New York City, of course, is a perfect example of this. So the question is, though, how do we move forward? Cities can't be put under glass and preserved, and they have to be dynamic and economically competitive. And so the question in Boston and New York and elsewhere is how do we fill in the vacant parcels and create more density and make sure it's oriented around transit while maintaining that sort of human scale urban neighborhood that Jacobs taught us to appreciate?
Well, we've all already talked about the development of her thinking. As a journalist, when did she begin focusing her attention on Robert Moses?
Well, she was the housewife from Scranton. You know, she was raising three kids in 555 Hudson Street. She was actually working for the State Department for a bit and worked on a magazine called America that was a publication distributed in the Soviet Union. And she took her kids to Washington Square Park. Then one day in around about 1955, she learned of the Moses proposal for the roadway through Washington Square Park. He actually wanted to extend Fifth Avenue through the park so that a development on the southern side of the park could have a Fifth Avenue address. And that's when she became a citizen activist, joining others who were against the roadway, and sort of dipping her toe into this whole community activism business, which she became very good at.
Initially, was Robert Moses at all concerned about ordinary citizens battling him over his plan to go through Washington Park and bring Fifth Avenue down to where? What street would have been sacrificed?
Fifth Avenue would have connected in what is now LaGuardia Place, mm-hmm. Down to Houston Street.
Would have screwed up all the numbering of Fifth Avenue. I mean, one does begin at Washington Square Park.
And it would have bisected this treasured green space and with a lot of concrete and cars and so forth. And so, yes, she was.
But did he have concern? Did he just dismiss these activists?
He definitely did. He was used to getting his way. He took on mayors and governors. Mayors were afraid to fire him. He was in all these appointed positions, and he even took on President Roosevelt and kind of won. So there weren't many people who were having a lot of success standing up to him, and he always viewed the citizens as a group to be outmaneuvered and dealt with.
He often got good press, but in this case, Jane Jacobs knew how to get good press.
Yes, she was very savvy in that way, or became very savvy in that way. She knew when it was a slow news day. She knew what would make a good photo op. For example, she had her daughter and another young girl go out and tie a ribbon at Washington Square Park. Now, this is the reverse of the ribbon cutting for the big, mm-hmm. Moses Project. I always thought that was very clever. And, of course, she got that picture in many newspapers. Moses really couldn't believe what was happening. And in fact, according to Jane Jacobs, at one point he said about the roadway proposal, there's nobody against this but a bunch of mothers.
Well, she enlisted a prominent journalist who was my boss here at WNYC for a while, Mary Parrott Nichols. Where was she in those days at the Village Voice?
The Village Voice was an incredible emerging force and a wonderful neighborhood newspaper that was looking for stories. So, yes, it was a perfect match. Jane enlisted those reporters and writers and really publicized the cause.
And then in 1958, the New York Secretary of State, Carmine DiSapio, who was also the political boss, Tammany Hall here, held a press conference in the Village and said that Washington Square Park represented one of the city's most priceless possessions, and as such, it belongs to every one of our 8 million fellow New Yorkers. That must have stunned Robert Moses. When did it become certain that the park wouldn't be developed? Was that it?
Ultimately, 1959, it was celebrated with a sort of a symbolic final car going through the Washington Square Park arch. There were still buses that were allowed to turn around there, but that ended shortly afterwards, around about 1961.
And then Robert Moses said, "There's something to be said for letting unreasonable opposition have its way." Because people will find out that it doesn't work.
Right,
and
yes.
And they'll be sorry.
Yes, and they get what they deserve. In fact, though, and you see this today on Broadway and in other places and with Mayor Bloomberg's congestion pricing proposal, in fact, when you calm the traffic and you simply give cars another route using the street grid, or you encourage people to walk or bicycle or take transit, you don't get these traffic jams after all.
Then what? A listener suggests that all of her successes are now being dismantled by NYU. So maybe NYU is more powerful than Robert Moses in the Village.
Well, they started to be in cahoots at that time in the 50s and 60s, and Jane was active on some of those issues and the building proposals. It's a constant tension. Colleges and universities these days are really trying to be better partners in the urban neighborhoods where they reside. Whether NYU has been successful in that, I don't know.
So when did Robert Moses propose the Lower Manhattan Expressway? Around the same time?
Well, it was one of several crosstown expressways that he had in mind. Another was the Mid-Manhattan Expressway, which was about at 34th Street. Another would have gone across about at 125th Street. The one he did build, of course, was the Cross Bronx Expressway. So he had a number of these crosstown expressways in mind. The Lower Manhattan Expressway really was formally proposed in the late 50s, and Moses moved ahead with it between 1960 and 68.
It had the support of President Eisenhower when he signed the National Interstate and Defense Highways Act. He envisioned superhighways and other highways all throughout the country. But it wouldn't have been as destructive as the Cross Bronx Expressway, would it? Because Soho was an area of small businesses at that point.
It was, but it was also a place of incredible cast iron facade architecture. There were a lot of jobs, working class jobs. There was Little Italy. There was the Lower East Side where the Tenement Museum is today.
All that would be destroyed?
All of that would have been destroyed. In fact, there are many thousand of your listeners who would not be where they are right now if the Lower Manhattan Expressway went through. It was 10 lanes, elevated, and it would have joined the Holland Tunnel and the Manhattan and Williamsburg bridges.
She made an argument that we've heard a lot since, that building new highways just invites more traffic that quickly fills the lanes to capacity.
It's this notion of induced demand, and it's really been proven where you have expanded highways, and particularly highways through cities. The trade-off just wasn't there. What could possibly be worth ripping apart the urban fabric in this way just for the swift flow of traffic, just so that traffic could move from really from New Jersey to Long Island?
You begin the book with a public hearing at a Lower East Side high school auditorium that ends with her being arrested.
Well, when she kept standing up and challenging the establishment, I suppose it was bound to get her in trouble. She was arrested at one other time at a Vietnam War protest. But at this particular hearing, she was ultimately charged with inciting a riot. This was because she stood up and ended up being in the middle of a raucous protest of sort of civil disobedience that involved ripping up the stenotype record of the meeting and tossing it in the air like confetti. So, yes, she was hauled away in the back of a squad car.
And what happened?
Well, there was...
She didn't go to jail.
She was booked and released much later that night. I think it shook her up a bit to actually go through that process, and this inciting a riot charge came along shortly after.
But you suggest that that arrest marked the beginning of Robert Moses' fall from power.
It really signaled the twilight of his career, and for various other reasons, including Governor Rockefeller moving him off of the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority. He remained with his vision and wanted to do other projects like the Rye Oyster Bay crossing, the big bridge that would have gone over Long Island Sound. But really, that defeat and her arrest marked the end of his reign as the power broker.
Well, it's interesting that he his successes are not all the highways, although there were a few. He doubled the green space of New York City to nearly 35,000 acres, added 658 playgrounds, 17 miles of beach, zoos, recreation centers, ball fields. But then at the end, all he seemed to want to do was build highways. What happened?
Well, he did many good things.
Riverside Park. It's a treasure.
Jones Beach is, to this day, it's a marvel, just an incredible public works. And his appreciation for infrastructure and how important that is to support a city, I think, is something that we can learn from today. But yes, I think he just took it too far. After the Interstate Highways Act, he was very good at funneling money, getting federal money for these projects. And the Interstate Highway Act encouraged him to keep building and keep funneling money to New York City. He just took it a few highways too far.
Do you think one of the reasons Jane Jacobs left the city, you mentioned concern for her sons during the Vietnam War, was also her notoriety at that point, that just too many people wanted a piece of her?
She claimed not to like being a celebrity. And she said that she was very annoyed at the way that she had to fight government initiatives, and was kind of a reference to men like Moses. She wanted just to write, and she never authorized a biography. She was very private and didn't like the limelight, although she did keep all the articles written about her and shared them with her dear mother.
Just one more thing. A listener asks about cities like Tucson and Phoenix. What's the influence of Jane Jacobs there?
Well, I think in places like Phoenix, you really see, they're concentrating a lot on their downtown now. And this is Phoenix we're talking about, the place where you see all the sprawling subdivisions. Well, all the action right now is in downtown Phoenix. They are putting in a light rail transit network in Phoenix. And so I think that places like Phoenix are recognizing the powerful elements of a good urban neighborhood that Jane Jacobs embraced.
I want to thank you so much for being with us today. We've been talking with Anthony Flint. His book, Wrestling with Moses, How Jane Jacobs Took on New York's Master Builder and Transformed the American City. It's published by Random House. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.